everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, episode 274. My name is Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Senatas, makers of fine, fine crypto hardware. So if you need some crypto in your second layer, they make layer two stuff, I would suggest you get in touch with them. Awesome gear. And as you'll hear in this week's sponsor interview with Senatas co-founder and CTO Julian Fay, these guys really know their stuff. Julian joins the show a little bit later on to chat about what happens when his customers ask Senatas to roll with custom algos, to roll custom algos into their hardware, because some of them don't trust published crypto techniques. It's just an all-round interesting chat, and it's coming up later on. In this week's feature interview, we chat with Jennifer Granick, the head of civil liberties at Stanford University's Center for Internet and Society. Jennifer has extensive experience and expertise in cyber law. She recently defended Aaron Swartz. She's also acted as an attorney for HB Gary. She has done it all from multiple angles in the InfoSec space over a long period of time. And she joins the show today to talk about a few things. Is active defense ever legal, for example? And what the hell is going on with the Computer Abuse and Fraud Act over there in the USA? We got Weave going to prison. We've got, really overzealous prosecutors going after guys like Aaron Swartz, who tragically committed suicide. So is this an act that needs reform? We'll be chatting with Jennifer about that after the news. Speaking of which, it is time now to check the week's news headlines with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, some massive news this week. South Korea apparently getting all cyber-warred by the nutters from the north.
Yeah, there was a bunch of breaking news yesterday, actually, where several TV stations and a couple of banks in South Korea got owned by some kind of malware that at exactly 20 after 2 in the afternoon vaped their boxes, like just, you know, filled the disks with a repeated string and then shut themselves down across, you know, three TV stations and two banks all at once, which is a pretty serious business cyber war attack, if you'll excuse my my use of the phrase.
Yeah, well, I mean, it really reminds me of the attack against Saudi Aramco, the Saudi royal family's oil company, which we saw last year.
Yeah, there is certainly some similarities there. I mean, the the vaping the disc and the attempting to take out a particular large organization as some kind of warning, about the or demonstration of capability. And I think there's definitely some parallels there. And of course, you would be forgiven for saying, well, the North Koreans and the Iranians already share techniques related to other things. Maybe they would share some things there. Although certainly there's no direct digital evidence that would tie these two things together. But the MO looks pretty similar.
Yeah, look, and there's no concrete attribution, as is always the case with this sort of stuff. But the the action just screams North Korea. All that they do is act like crazy people until sanctions are lifted or they get food aid, which sort of props up the regime. And, we saw some UN sanctions passed against them because they tested a nuke, and China even got on board with that. So the Security Council passed some sanctions. So now they're throwing their toys out of the pram. And this looks like the same sort of typical North Korea behavior, which is to make life very tough for people, make everyone feel quite threatened until they get the monies. They're actually releasing propaganda videos of North Korean nukes, turning Washington, D.C. into a fireball and mentioning that U.S. bases in Guam and Japan are actually within range of their nukes. I mean, this is, classic North Korea stuff, right?
Yeah, I watched one of the propaganda videos, and it is pretty funny stuff. I watched it without subtitles, so it didn't make any sense, of course. But, it was, lots of resounding music and victories for the the great DPRK.
Yeah, and from what I understand too, I mean, people are throwing this cyber war term around pretty loosely lately, but from what I understood from seeing Bob Clark's presentation at OSCERT last year, and he was the operational attorney for the US Army Cyber Command, I don't believe this is technically an act of war, which is interesting.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you should mention that. Of course, we saw this week the release of the first draft of the Tallinn Manual, which is the result of a NATO think tank talking about exactly what is cyber war, and we'll get to that, I guess, a bit later on. But certainly, if you were sitting in South Korea at this point, you would feel pretty sort of warred upon, I guess.
Yes, warred upon. I like that. That's a nice turn of phrase. Now, look, just staying with this before we get to that, that NATO think tank development, we'll just stay with the Korea thing for a moment. And South Korea says it's actually traced the attack back to IP addresses in China, which I don't know really tells us a great deal.
Well, of course not, right? I mean, I imagine that if you run a website in South Korea, then probably geo-IPing people coming from North Korea, all four of them, and blocking them wouldn't be something that would be something you're already doing, I imagine. But yeah, certainly, attributing it to an IP in China is going to shock no one. Of course, what's more interesting, I think, is A, that the Korean government actually dropped that IP in a press release, no redaction or anything. So I had a quick look around, and, there's very, very little of anything else has come out of or is related to that particular IP, but we're beginning to see some attribution work around the droppers and the way that intrusion was gained.
We've also seen a couple of statements suggesting that the malware itself is out of China, which isn't really surprising given that North Korea and China are actually quite strategically aligned, so you'd think that there would be some expertise sharing between the two countries. Doesn't mean China's in on it, but it just it's logical, right?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly looked like they were using a Chinese exploit kit in kind of watering hole and phishing style attacks to get in initially. There are some other suggestions that the malware is, specifically targeting things in South Korea, whether or not it's coming specifically from China. But yeah, attribution is very difficult, and it looks, very much like a targeted and fairly well orchestrated sort of thing. I mean, there was some suggestion that the malware that was used to actually do the wiping was dropped as little as a couple of days ago. So that demonstrates a very, very rapid progress from initial entry to lateral movement around the TV stations and the banks to let's just wipe everything. The malware also apparently was dropping a script that would look for Unix boxes. So if you had PuTTY or CRT set up to connect to your Unix boxes, it would steal the credentials and then SCP up a nasty bash script to the Unix boxes and actually vape them as well. So that's that's not a small operation here, eh? It's quite for all the bluntness of the mechanism, it's quite a sophisticated operation.
Now look, as we just mentioned, there was this Tallinn manual released, which is sort of like a proposed code for cyber war ops, and it's not so much new law, but trying to seek a uniform understanding of international law as it applies to all things cyber. I mean, did you have a chance to actually read the manual?
I haven't read all of the words in it because it's quite long. And if you're not an international, international relations lawyer, then some of it may be a bit lost in you. But certainly I read, a reasonable portion of it. I read a couple of write-ups of it. But it's, the primary point to make about this is that it's a document which is, A, the result of a bunch of, fairly well-educated and smart people thinking about how you should compare existing international relations as they cover war, like the Geneva Convention, for example, and relating those to what they should mean in a cyber world. None of this is, of course, policy or law. It's really just kind of a guidance of what they think is reasonable. And it, by and large, I guess it is fairly reasonable. The second thing to note is that it's really about military cyber stuff, not so much espionage or civilian things, although it does touch on, at what point an independent, sort of civilian non-state actor doing, things that are nasty to other countries is kind of, within the purview of the military. So it's an interesting document, but it doesn't cover off, a fairly large amount of the things that we're really worried about. I mean, like economic espionage.
That's the thing. I mean, under international law, as I understand it, espionage isn't actually a problem under international law, because traditionally you'd have your agents exposed for arrest in the country where they're operating. And that was kind of like, you didn't really require an international law against that stuff. So maybe we will in the future. But it's interesting what you said about, when does someone actually become attached to a military apparatus? We've seen in a lot of countries like China in the past and Iran now, we've seen ultranationalists who wind up working in cahoots with governments. Now, Russia Today, which is a Russian news service, has interpreted this as meaning that NATO is declaring hackers military targets. They've written a story up, which I've included in the show notes. It strikes me as being a little bit of a beat up to me. But it's saying, you know, like if you're an anonymous guy, you know, you could be, you could wind up with a fucking Polaris missile up your ass, you know, which is a bit of a funny interpretation.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that you can read out of it. And I think, you know, the important thing here is that it is a starting point for a bunch of discussions that we're going to have over the next 10 years.
Now, look, in some non-cyber war-related news, we saw a very interesting bit of research, or was it a very interesting crime, this week? Someone has, you know, some time ago we had HD Moore on the show. He was talking about how, you know, he did some wide-scale scanning of the internet and he found a lot of very vulnerable embedded devices. And there was definitely evidence that someone had been there doing something to them before. Now, someone's just published a research paper where they've freely admitted to actually trojaning up all of these devices and using them to scan the net. And they've written a really interesting paper out of it. And they've said, oh, but I cleaned up after myself and I didn't do any harm. I mean, it's fascinating.
It is. It's absolutely fascinating piece of research. And, you know, once the data comes in that's, you know, the guy's released on a torrent, I'm sure I'll be very interested to have a rummage through it. But yeah, it's, wow. You know, like sitting down one day and saying, you know what? I'm going to scan the whole internet and I'm going to do that by owning, you know, several thousand boxes in the process and making them scan the internet for me and working that up to the point where you're collecting, you know, terabytes of scan data and you're scanning, you know, like one port across the entire internet in the space of about an hour. You know, that's a fairly serious distributed system. And the amount of engineering work that goes into building that, testing that, running all the collection, running the, you know, kind of the C2 infrastructure. Like, there's a multi-tier C2 infrastructure. There's, you know, Hadoop clusters processing the data. This is fairly serious business work.
Yeah.
And, you know, to do all of that with several thousand stolen boxes the cojones on that guy or lady, as it may be.
Yeah, well, I think HD Moore is downloading the data set still as we speak, or he was a couple of days ago, and said he was really going to be interested to run some diffing between that data and the data that he's collected just to see if this approach is more effective.
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody who's been doing this kind of research, I mean, obviously, you know, I've done stuff with low-hanging Kivra, which is, you know, several orders of magnitude smaller than this. And I'm really interested to see, you know, what insights I can get from the data. So, I mean, the torrent's going to, you know, got a couple more days to run, I think, because it's a fairly large amount of data.
Yeah, I just love this, though. Like, it just strikes me as the sort of research paper that's just based on the premise of why the f*** not.
Well, exactly, and that's pretty much what the currently anonymous person who did it said. You know, it's like, well, you know, why not, right? If I can get away with it and you know, get something interesting out of it, and you know, I'll try not to be too much of a dick whilst, you know, totally breaking the law.
Yeah, well, you know. Also, fun fact: CNetNews.com originally attributed this for some inexplicable reason, because this person's gone to a great deal of trouble to stay anonymous because what they did is terribly illegal. But they. CNetNews.com, for some inexplicable reason, attributed this to Fyodor, Gordon Lyon, said, oh, you know, the researcher, Gordon Lyon. And it was just because it was posted to Seclist and it was like an Nmap thing. Like, what the hell? And I wrote to him on IM, Gordon, and I said, dude, you didn't do this, did you? I mean, did you tell this journal? Like, why would you go to that much work to be this? I think they f***ed up here. And I think it was about 2 hours until he'd, you know, come home from dinner or whatever and, like, you know, replied to me, and he's just like, whoa, thanks for the heads up. And it turns out, yeah, big mistake, and they've corrected the story. So, yeah.
Yeah, that was it was certainly a pretty, you know, slanderous sort of write-up coming out of CNET there. And, yeah, like, so clearly just a you know, it just doesn't, doesn't make any sense, and it didn't stand up to any sort of analysis. But yeah, like, dear, I really hope that, you know, people over at CNET are, you know, thinking about what they've done. Although I didn't think that their retraction didn't really contain much of an apology to Fyodor, which I thought maybe was a little bit warranted.
Now, look, going back to all things intelligence agency and spooky and all of that, turns out someone's uncovered a decade old malware that has been doing the rounds and obviously being used for espionage purposes, which begs the question, why on earth have we only found out about this now? Go UAV guys, yay.
Well, I mean, you know, clearly the AV industry has, you know, delivered exactly what we expected, i.e. not much. But yeah, it really doesn't look very good for them or for, you know, I guess the InfoSec industry as a whole to be sitting here going, yeah, actually, you know what? The Russians have indeed been spying on you for 10 years. Sorry about that.
Yes. Yes. So anyway, interesting little aside there. And you wonder how much other malware's, you know, 10-year-old high-grade espionage malware is rattling around on the tubes just waiting to be uncovered. Oh, now, staying with them.
A bunch.
Well, there's one possible solution, and the CIA might actually be onto that, which is they're about to sign a $600 million deal with Amazon. Move it to the cloud.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess, you know, maybe it makes a lot of sense. You know, they got to store their data somewhere, they got to compute somewhere, and I'm glad they're not sticking it in Amazon's public cloud. But yeah, while $60 million a year does buy you a lot of boxes, I guess, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, what they do with it and what, you know, what kind of comes out of that in terms of improvements to Amazon's service line. But yeah, it's an interesting time.
Yeah, look, I mean, it looks like what they're actually doing is having Amazon build them a data center, essentially, or build them a cloud using Amazon technology, which seems, you know, it seems to be like a good way to leverage, you know, Amazon's tech, which is actually pretty good in terms of, like, you know, creating cloud-based storage processing, all of that sort of stuff, without exposing yourself fully to the risks of being in a public cloud. So, yeah, it's a brave decision, you would think, but we'll just have to see how that one turns out. But big win for Amazon, that's for sure. Now, look.
Yeah, definitely.
Last week or the week before, we covered a story about a website for a television show on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the ABC. It got hacked, 50,000 email addresses and hashed passwords were leaked. The email addresses that people used to register at that site with have been spammed, and I love this, by a company trying to sell UGG boots. And it looks like what's happened is some, you know, marketing provider or whatever has gone, oh, 50,000 Australian email addresses, sweet,
yeah.
And just incorporated them into a mail-out list, and then these boots guys have done a big mail-out, and it's all blown up, and it's in the Sydney Morning Herald, and it's pretty funny.
Yeah, I really feel sorry for the poor UGG boot people. You know, they just want to sell some UGG boots, you know, and all of a sudden now they're, you know, an international, you know, spammer and, you know, tied up in using stolen data and things like, and, you know, clearly it's not their fault. Like, as you say, like, clearly some, you know, some jerk online marketing company sold them a mailing list. But, yeah, this is, you know, it's sad for everybody involved, but also tragic and funny.
But, you know, winter is coming and those UGG boots are now only $88. So I would think that much like Hell Pizza's disaster a couple of years ago where they wound up all over the news for losing their customer data, I would imagine that Oz Boots, the fine folks over at Oz Boots, have probably wound up selling quite a few pairs out of this whole thing. Now, it has been an absolutely massive week of news in information security, and another thing that has happened is Weave has been sentenced to 3.5 years in Pound Me in the Ass prison.
Yeah, and I guess I'm kind of conflicted about this because, you know, 3.5 years in jail for this particular thing, right, it does seem a little disproportionate to me. But on the other hand, you know, clearly Weave is kind of a dick. And, you know, some deterrence to future dickery would be, you know, is a good thing, I think, for the internet. But, yeah, the thing that really...
Can you deter that level of douchebaggery? I think it's ingrained in the dude's DNA. But, I mean, you know, for those who aren't familiar with what we're talking about, a couple of years ago, you know, Weave and his buddy, I think it was his mate, actually, they managed to slurp a whole bunch of user ID from AT&T because they didn't really protect the data. It was just obscured by URL. So they managed to get all of these iPad IDs and email addresses. And then they, you know, were jumping up and down and talking to the media and going, look at how awesome we are. And they were really trying to spin it into a bit of publicity and use it to launch a security company called Goatsy Security. And it kind of backfired, and now he's in prison.
Yeah, and that's not a bad outcome. But the thing that upsets me about this thing is, you know, the fact that he got, you know, it, what to me seems like an unfair sentence. You know, now we end up with the EFF, you know, who are going to go to bat in an appeal against this, you know, saying, you know, using his name and Aaron Schwartz's name in the same sentence, and that's just kind of offensive. And that's just not going to help anyone. So yeah, like I wish they had given him at least something, but not kind of that bad, so that we ended up, you know, comparing him to Aaron Schwartz.
Yeah, well, we've got a this week's feature interview is with Jennifer Granick, who of course actually represented Aaron Schwartz. So we'll be hearing from her in just a little while, talking about the Computer Abuse and Fraud Act and how crackheaded it is, which is a fun chat. Now, the social media editor at Reuters, he's also not having such a good time because apparently he was a disgruntled ex-employee, allegedly, of the Los Angeles Times. And he's working over there at Reuters, and he's in a chat room with some anons, and he's like, well, here's my, you know, if you guys really want to get in there and like some shit up, here's some passwords that I snuck out with me when I left. Turns out the guy that he was leaking the passwords to was none other than everybody's favorite snitch, Sabu.
Oh, dear. Yeah, that's just that. You got to be face palming after that. Okay, like, really, guy, this was, you know, a bad life choice to start with. But yeah, the fact that he told an FBI snitch credentials to his previous employer, like that.
The best bit is now he's claiming he was actually undercover. So he's an undercover journalist, and let's see how that goes for you guys.
Yeah, good luck with that, buddy. I don't see that one going very well.
But look, it could have been part of some big media Reuters sting. Who knows?
Maybe.
Well, we'll see. Yes, I suspect not.
Dick.
We'll see. Anyway, going with some bread and butter InfoSec news, have you noticed how much these days we tend to be talking about policy and geopolitics? And it's just amazing, isn't it? But here we have some actual bread and butter information security news. And Google is going with DNSSEC. They are rolling with DNSSEC for their public DNS servers, which is a big step for a technique and a protocol that probably should have been adopted sometime in 2001, but, better late than never.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, DNSSEC is an important piece of securing our tubes, and much as DNS, raises the ire of everyone involved with it, it is an important piece of the puzzle, and Google deploying it on their public resolvers is clearly a good thing, and will help, push things along. So, big ups to Google for doing it.
Big shocking news this week. There's a potential sandbox bypass in Java.
Yeah, those sneaky Polish buggers been at it again, and have dropped some more details about the specific techniques that they were, that Oracle have been claiming are actually by design. So we may have another plausible sandbox escape for Java in the pipe.
Yeah.
Which, I don't think anyone is very surprised about, sadly.
Now, look, there's some interesting news here. Samsung Android phones are still being plagued with quite a few bugs, which is... Yeah, I think this story is interesting because it just goes to show that even though they're Android handsets, quite often there are weaknesses in the proprietary software that these guys wrap the Android stuff in. So, yeah, few quality control problems over there at Samsung.
Yeah, definitely. There's been some research that has looked at a number of the pieces of the Samsung, preloaded crap where you get on their Android phones, and of course, all sorts of problems with those in terms of local privilege escalation and vulnerabilities and things. And we've seen that with HTC in the past. And I'm sure, was it LG who shipped the driver that just let you write to arbitrary kernel memory?
That was a fun one.
this is I don't think anyone is particularly shocked about this, but yeah, it's clearly they need to improve it. And the fact that we did see some action against HTC in the US, hopefully sent a message to the other vendors, but they just want to sell you another phone. They don't want to secure their particular piece of like dialer or MMS client or whatever the hell crap that they're putting on the phones.
Oh, now here's a real fun one. UIM'd this to me, I think it was yesterday, or was it overnight? Anyway, doesn't matter, it's beside the point. The point is, Cisco, in its infinite wisdom, actually switched to a less secure hashing algorithm for password storage. I mean, how does this happen? It's kind of funny, isn't it, right?
It is. It's hilarious, right? So, yeah, Cisco, if you've ever looked at a Cisco config, you'll know that they have password hashes or reversibly encrypted passwords in some cases over the years. Anyway, and they have different types of password hashes, and they introduced a new one, which is called their Type 4 hash, which is supposed to supersede their existing Type 5 hash. Type 5 is like an iterated MD5. Anyway, so they decided that, for their new hashing standard, they were going to use something, that was appropriate for hashing passwords, something that was purpose-designed. And they chose, quite correctly, PBKDF2, which is a, iterated SHA-256 thing that's specifically designed for password hashing. Unfortunately for Cisco, and I guess for everyone who uses it, they, whilst they meant to implement PBKDF2, what they actually implemented was a single round of SHA-256 with no salt.
Yay.
which is actually significantly worse than the existing Type 5. Now, how the hell that made it through testing? And actually got out into production, release trains of iOS. I have no idea. Like, what the f*** is going on down there at Cisco?
Really? Yeah, no, it's a, I'm scratching my head on that one as well. And you wonder, if this stays in production, will it be a hard thing to actually sort out? I mean, can they just update this simply? Because I would have thought if people are creating hashes, I mean, how do you then actually upgrade the hashing algorithm and then without getting people to re-enter their passwords? I mean, how does that work?
Well, I think the only thing that's really saving them here is how new this is and the fact that it has only been in production for a few weeks. So there's a, you know, they probably can get away with making people regenerate the passwords when they update. But man, what a cock up.
Yeah, no, pretty spectacular. Now, another company has finally rolled with two-factor authentication. Apple has added two-step verification for Apple IDs. So, you know, yet another fantastic little, you know, two-factor auth application that you can install on your mobile device, because I know I've got like two or three already.
Yeah, well, you know, that is a problem, I guess. But I mean, overall, the fact that, you know, it is even an option that we have two-factor auth and that it appears to work fairly well based on what I've seen so far, you know, the fact that it's just going to push all the attackers off to our mobile phones and get us owned there, like, okay, like, let's just put that aside for now and accept that, yes, Apple did a good thing. Thank you.
Oh, now, look, terrific story that's come out of Melbourne. It's made global headlines in InfoSec, which is Crown Casino, which is actually a very large casino down there in Melbourne. It got owned by a high roller who had someone somehow get unauthorized access to camera feeds, which gave them, you know, which meant someone was sitting down watching other people's cards, stuff like that, and then feeding intel back to this guy, telling him when to bet. They lost $32 million, apparently, and didn't even report it to the police. So red faces all around at Crown.
Yeah, it's. I haven't seen any specific details about exactly how they got access to the camera systems, whether it was just, you know, a staff member being paid off, or whether there was actually some technical aspect to the attack. And, you know, you'd like to believe that, you know, you wouldn't just rock up to a casino, plug into the first Ethernet port you find on the wall, and then, you know, SNMP,
do some ARP spoofing or whatever.
Yeah, you know, like all your way across to where the camera systems are. But, you know, realistically, that probably would work.
Look, I just quickly want to mention it. There's a botnet called Chameleon, which is apparently making about $6 million a month in click fraud. So it's just a reminder to all of us that click fraud botnets are still out there, and you can read all about that in this week's show notes. Adam, that is all we're going to have time for this week, mate. Thank you very much, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Oh, cheers, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
Insomnia Security's Adam Bailot there, joining us for a look at the week's news headlines. With big thanks to this week's sponsor, Senatas, and also our hosting provider, Virtual Office, OFFIS. And those guys have had a very busy couple of days fending off a pretty epic DDoS attack aimed at one of their hosting customers, which is a global brand. And they've done a very good job keeping things up and running, given the volume of this thing. So if you're listening, hang in there, guys, and good work. Now, before we get into this week's feature interview, I just want to remind you all out there that I'm recruiting security consultants for two clients. If you are an experienced security consultant in Perth, Melbourne, Canberra, Sydney, or Brisbane, I might have a nice big fat cash job for you. A full description has been posted to risky.biz. Go and have a look. And for some reason, everyone assumes that I'm recruiting these roles for StratSec or Dedica or whatever they're called this week, but I'm not. It's a smaller company, staffed with some very clever people who do some very interesting work. That's one of them. And another one is a fairly typical boutique pen testing style firm. So go have a look on the website and get in touch with me, Patrick at risky.biz, if you're interested, or call me, text me, 0411-696-384. It's time for this week's feature interview now with Jennifer Granick, the Head of Civil Liberties at Stanford University's Center for Internet and Society. Jennifer knows the law as it applies to all things InfoSec very well, and she joined me via Skype from the USA to chat about a few things, actually. Now, regular listeners would have heard Dan Gear on the show last week saying private organizations should be allowed to attack botnets and disable them without fear of legal reprisals. I thought it would be great to get some expert legal opinion on that. And also we talk about the crackheadedness of the United States Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. But I started off by asking Jennifer about some simple jurisdictional issues. If I'm an Australian attacker and I own a network in the USA, where was the crime committed? The victim and most of the evidence is in the United States. So is that where the crime scene is? On the other hand, the computer from which the attack was launched must also form a part of the crime scene, you would think. So in which country's courts should the offender be charged? Here she is.
Well, I think it is. I think it actually is that simple. I think that the crime scene is both where the attacker was and where the target was. So, you know, and it's the harder question is what about the computers used in between? But yeah, I think that either Australian or United States officials would have jurisdiction to say, you know, here's where the where the effects were felt, or here's where the attack took place. And either of those would be plausible places to investigate or to bring legal action. The problem there is, you know, if you're going to bring legal action, then you face extradition. And we've seen some issues with people being extradited. You know, that's a big issue in the Kim.com mega upload case. The New Zealand authorities have to decide whether to extradite him to the United States. It was also a big issue in the TV Shack case, where Richard O'Dwyer, who was in the UK, was ordered to be extradited to the United States to face copyright infringement claims before they decided to not extradite him and drop it, because it became increasingly obvious that U.S. law was not clear that providing links to infringing TV shows is a crime here.
Yeah, that's a that's an interesting little law, that one.
It has to be a crime both places. That's kind of the secret.
Well, that's the thing with extradition, right? And I believe even the sentencing guidelines have to mesh. Like, you know, they have to be roughly equivalent, right?
Yeah, I think most treaties, we do it that way. You know, we have treaties for extradition, and we want to know that there's parity in the law, and that's parity both in terms of severity and in terms of content. And that makes sense. Nations don't want to have to extradite their citizens to stand trial in other countries for things that are legal here or aren't all that big of a deal here.
Well, we are the convict nation. We don't tend to send people off to prison for, you know, stuff like computer hacking, you know, especially when they're just having fun. But say, okay, so say some dude hacks into a U.S. company from Australia. I mean, I'm presuming that they might, it's possible that Australian authorities might be able to charge them for actually, you know, committing a crime where the victim was in another jurisdiction. I mean, that's not really a problem, is it?
No, that's not a problem. That's not a problem. They could either charge, the person could either be prosecuted in Australia, or there could be a request for extradition and then sent over to the United States to stand trial here.
Now, the reason I'm, you know, my curiosity around extradition and where crime scenes are located and whatnot has been renewed is, I don't know if you caught the news, but recently a government official in India turned up to a sort of hacker event and threw down a bounty of about $600 and said, you know, whoever can take down this botnet will win this bounty, because the botnet had been, you know, giving the government a hard time. Now, obviously, taking down that botnet would have required a little bit of active exploitation. There would have been laws broken in that case. How much of a legal challenge is this when we've got people actually acting to the benefit of everyone, but clearly breaking computer crime laws?
Yeah, that, I mean, this is one of the issues, and some people have been pushing either for a practice or for a legal exception for whatever you call it, active defense or whatever it is, under the idea that, you know, to sit around passively doesn't do any good. And I think that, you know, from a technological standpoint, there are a variety of things you can do other than just sit around passively if you're under attack. But I think the botnet example is the one that showcases most clearly what the problem is with approving, you know, hackbacks or retaliatory attacks. Because here you have a situation where the people, the computer who are attacking you, the owners are innocent. These are zombies in a botnet. And so you have, you know, people's machines of varying degrees of fragility and importance, and to just have a blunt tool that says, you know, you can hack them because they've been hacked, can create a whole bunch of economic and social and criminal problems.
Look, I get what you're saying, but I think maybe our understanding of malware has moved on a little bit from a technological point of view over the last 10 years, so that whereas before you wouldn't want to sort of gain access to one of these zombie systems that have been affecting you because you might do something unintended to that system, these days, the science of removing malware from an infected zombie is pretty well understood. So it's reasonable to assume, it's safe to assume, that it's possible for, say, the security team of Facebook to take down a botnet without doing any damage, further damage, to those zombies. So do you think maybe some of the arguments against this type of activity are a little bit null and void these days?
I don't think so. I'm still not, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I still don't think, first of all, it's still illegal. There's not a, you know, botnet exception in our computer crime law. And I think that there's some real question about, you know, people always say, well, what about common law doctrines like self-defense and stuff? And I'm like, that's awesome. I wouldn't advise anybody to have that be the thing that, you know, have some cute intellectual argument like that be the thing that stands between them and prison. so don't be the test case. But I understand what you're saying, but I think that, you know, I know what you're saying, but I'm not confident that we're in a position where, you know, we can say, okay, well, if, you know, it's a botnet, you can patch it for the entity.
But I wonder, I mean, you know, when it's clear that people know what they're doing and they, you know, and it's known that they're acting in, you know, overwhelming in the public interest and they're looking out for some of these unintended consequences. I mean, I'm wondering what prosecutor would actually want to make a case. Now, I'm talking about jurisdictions outside of the US because overzealous prosecution is something I want to get to a little bit later on in this interview. Because yeah. I can actually imagine a DA in the US trying to bring charges against, you know, Google's security team for disabling a botnet that's been hammering the government just because, you know, your entire legal system is very, very weird to us. But can you imagine, you know, a reasoned prosecutor actually taking action against someone for taking down a botnet? And who's going to be filing the criminal complaint? That's another thing I don't get, you know?
Well, yeah, I guess it's the owner of the zombie computer who would be the one who complains. Also, you know, at least in our computer crime law, it's not just a criminal law. There's a civil enforcement provision as well. So it's not just a prosecutor you have to convince to leave you alone. It's the, you know, it's the person whose computer you accessed as well. And that's certainly a risk to be taking.
But I'm trying to understand what the complaint would actually be. Do you know what I mean? On behalf of someone who's been drafted into a botnet, say someone has accessed their system and sent a kill command. You know, I mean, usually the way this would work is someone would actually hack into the command and control systems, which are some compromised server in wherever, and then they would send a kill command to the virus, which would drop. I mean, where's the actual complaint? What's the problem? How is the person who participated in that botnet been harmed?
Well, any access to the computer that's unauthorized is a completion of the crime. So sending instructions to my computer without authorization, that's the crime.
So there doesn't need to be any sort of harm.
There doesn't necessarily need to be any sort of harm.
Because it's funny, you know, we've seen people suing LinkedIn saying you didn't use appropriate hashing algorithms on your, you know, on your passwords. And that means,
right.
You know, and those things get tossed out of court. So I'm wondering if, you know, if someone rings up and says, hey, you know, police, someone disabled a virus on my computer. I mean, you know, I understand that it's illegal, but I mean, how does that progress to Google's security team winding up in the clink? I just don't get it.
Yeah, well, with the privacy torts, for example, when a company doesn't protect your password, there's not a statute that says you can sue if they don't protect your password. You have to show that their actions invaded your privacy, and that requires a showing of standing, so you have to show harm. But for computer crimes, for example, the federal law for civil action, if certain types of data are revealed, or if it is, or if there's damage in a certain amount, then there's a cause of action. State laws may have civil causes of action just for the unauthorized access. So there, the unauthorized access plus the statute gives you the standing. You may not need to show anything other than that.
Now, I've got to ask, do you think this is a little bit silly? I mean, you expressed some reservations against legislative provisions that would allow for active defense. I mean,
I'm suspicious of the idea that we are good enough at stopping botnets that it's harmless to do so.
So you're against this based on a technology reason?
Yeah, I think, you know, I maybe would be able to be convinced for certain circumstances, but I'm not familiar with the idea that it's, you know, no biggie to just shut it off.
Because, I mean, we've seen Microsoft shut down botnets. I mean, they've obtained court orders which have given them physical access to command and control boxes.
The court orders are a big deal. You know, you have to make, there's supervision, you've made a demonstration to the court, there's some checks and balances there.
If Microsoft can go in and harmlessly shut down a botnet by getting physical access to the command and control, I mean, surely there could be a simplified process to allow, you know, non-physical access to that command and control? I mean, couldn't they go to a court and say, look, we want the court's permission to access this server, which is based in Kazakhstan. It is the command and control infrastructure for a botnet that is doing harm. It is not feasible for us to get physical access to it. We want the court's permission to actually gain virtual access to it to close down this botnet with the court's supervision. Is that an all a plausible
scenario? Bet Kazakhstan, it depends on how Kazakhstan feels about that, right? I mean, you could see the same thing. It's like, okay, these guys in Kazakhstan want access, they want their courts to give permission to access computers here in the United States. How are we feeling about that?
So you think there's going to be, maybe it could be the cause of a diplomatic row, could be a cause of war, World War III, surprisingly kicked off because of closing down a botnet between Kazakhstan.
It's comfortable when it's comfortable. It's us accessing them. It's not, the reciprocation of it is not as comfortable.
I just don't understand who really is going to protest this, who is going to be harmed, who is going to be injured apart from the bad guys. That's what I don't get. What's the solution to this, Jennifer?
I don't know what this is. Don't get owned.
It's easier said than done. All right, look, I want to move on for a bit of a chat about the computer. What is it? The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act?
Yeah.
What the hell? That's my question.
Is that your question?
That's my question.
So this law has been interpreted in a very broad way. And there is a push here in the United States to fix it, mostly inspired by the death of Aaron Swartz, who was being prosecuted under that statute for massive downloading of academic journal articles.
Yeah, I mean, they were trying to load him up with 35 years, or you can take a 4-month plea and be a convicted felon. I mean, it just seemed like... Yeah. What the hell is going on with your system when you can offer someone a 4-month plea, or the alternative is, well, we'll go for 35 years?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that they had said that they would ask for 7 years, but it's the same question. Like, what justifies 7 years? What justifies 7 years if you're offering 4 months? And truth be told, this is not something that's special about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. This is something that's just true about the way that the American criminal justice system works. We depend upon plea bargaining. Our system can't handle the volume of cases that go through it if we actually had a greater percentage of people go to trial. So everything has evolved in such a way that there is an immense amount of pressure on people once in the system to plead guilty and be done with it. Mm. And that pressure is felt even more acutely when you have a law that is vague and overbroad, but it's not that different from, a law that says that you get a minimum of 5 years or whatever for having crack cocaine. And so you can plead guilty and, help us turn someone else in and help us catch someone else, and like, well, people don't have a lot of choices.
Yeah, I mean, now it's not just the application law. I understand that, that is a big issue here. But the law itself doesn't seem to really give a crap about intent. It really seems to be a very cold law that you're either on the right side of or the wrong side of. Is that correct?
Well, it requires intentionality for the action, but not that you intend to do harm necessarily or those sorts of
things. Sorry, I intended to hack this, this journal article, but...
Yeah, you know. I intentionally gained access to this computer system, that kind
of thing. Yeah, but it doesn't really give a shit about why you were doing that.
Well, a little bit, but it's like, well, it was for a fraudulent reason because you were getting access to journal articles that you otherwise wouldn't have, you would have had to pay for or something like that. So the other elements are a little bit trumped up or easy to make.
Well, and we've also seen Weave get 3.5 years. I mean, this is something that makes me very, very happy and very, very sad all at once.
Weave has that special quality that enables us to have those mixed feelings.
Yeah. Half of me is like doing a Nelson from The Simpsons, and the other half of me is just, slapping myself on the face going, my God, 3.5 years for that. I mean, I can't imagine that would have even been charged here. I mean, it was basically, if you're saying as a company that our defense against people obtaining information from our database is they can't guess the URL. I mean, that's not a defense. That information wasn't stolen. It was published by AT&T. Yeah. I mean, how can this be?
I agree with that. I agree with that. You know, in Weave's case, it's even worse. He had a confederate who pulled the information out of the website and gave it to Weave, and then Weave basically was passing it around to make a big stink about it. So one of the things he was charged with was conspiracy to commit 1030 violation. Look carefully at his indictment. It's not even he did it, but that he was in cahoots with someone else who did it. So
cahoots. I really wish they would start using that word, substituting that word for conspiracy, because it's so much cooler. You are charged with second degree cahoots.
Yeah.
Much better. So what's going to happen with this Weave situation, you think? I mean, obviously he's going to appeal. Does he have a shot?
He has a shot. He's got great lawyers. He's got lawyers from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Orrin Kerr, who is a former computer crime prosecutor and now a law professor at George Washington University as his counsel on appeal. And, he's going to be making the argument you just made, which is that the information was published and he did nothing other than instruct the web server to spit it out. Orrin will probably also raise the conspiracy weirdness there. And we'll see what happened. But I think a lot of people, looking at the case are comparing the sentence he got to the sentences that were handed out in some other kinds of cases as well, and are reminding people that just because you're a troll doesn't mean you should go to prison. So
yeah, look, do you think this act itself needs reform though?
I think the law needs to be reformed. It needs to be clear that violating terms of service is not a crime. It needs to be clear that basic URL manipulation is not a crime. And I think it needs to be clear that if you're otherwise authorized to access information, accessing it in a manner that's undesirable, like downloading too fast or downloading at night or that kind of thing, is not a crime. There's a lot of things the law ostensibly covers that it really shouldn't. If my family, if my boyfriend wants to share his Netflix password with me, if I'm allowed on the network but I get blocked for downloading too fast, can I try again? There's just some basic stuff, like there's basic kinds of computer use that it's like, these things shouldn't be a crime. And there's some things we know for sure, but there's a whole category of other things that we can work towards fixing.
And do you think it's likely that this law will be reformed?
No, I don't.
Oh, that's cheery. Fantastic. That's what we love about this show. We talk about all of these wonderful things that are possible, taking down botnets without fear of, reprisals and law reform. And no, thanks. Good old Jennifer Wet Blanket Granick. Glad to have you on the show.
You're welcome. The politics of it are too much. I mean, yeah. I think that there are some big companies out there that are, that basically use this law to go after their wayward employees or their, software licensees that do stuff they don't like. Mm. And they're big and they're powerful. And there's the Department of Justice that never wants to limit its jurisdiction over criminal matters. And, there's not a lot of powerful entities arrayed on the other end, although you'd think there would be, because there are a lot of companies out there that make their living scraping and aggregating and analyzing data that's published. And all those companies should be, on our side. But there is a hope via the court system, because some courts have already started saying, this law isn't as broad as people are saying it is. It needs to be interpreted more narrowly. And the Ninth Circuit, which is where I live, and the Fourth Circuit have both done that. And I expect that to snowball. So
you think that there'll just be a refined application of the law, but it won't probably change itself?
Right.
Yeah. Now, look, finally, I just wanted to get your thoughts. I mean, something that's been bothering me for a while is the idea that we're sending idiot kids who use Loic to prison for, shutting down PayPal's blog for 20 minutes. I mean, what's your take on that? Because that seems insane to me. I mean, it's even happened in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I'm against that too, but I'll just explain the mentality. The idea is that we don't want people's websites getting shut down, so you make examples of it of the people that you're capable of catching.
Oh, look, I get it, but it still seems a little bit crazy.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so that's all we're going to say about that.
I mean, that's a very hard problem to fix. I guess you can fix penalties, but I don't know what else you can do. It's like, okay, you took down this person's website or this company's website, but it was easy and you're kind of a spazzy script kiddie. So
yeah, I mean, the solution is for companies to use DDoS prevention services if they don't want their websites DOSed by a group of 20 idiots.
I don't know how to enshrine that in the law. You know, I mean, if you can write me a statute, I'll maybe I can support it. But it's like, okay, take basic, you know, the idea would be, you know, if you don't take basic precautions and you get hacked, that's on you. It's not on the hacker. And that's just not the law. I mean, it's not our civil law, and it hasn't been our criminal law either.
But DDoS ain't hacking.
I agree.
You know, so I mean, I think the way to fix that one would be to stop prosecuting people for DDoS. Just stop prosecuting them completely, and eventually companies will get the message, right? And they're going to start using Prolexic. They're going to start using Arbor Networks. They're going to start using Cloudflare. You know, it's all sorted. But you know, a lot of people forget too that the PayPal thing, it was their blog for 20 minutes, and they're trying to say that there was, like, you know, $750,000 damage done. It's like, pull the other one, guys. Come on.
Yeah. I agree. And I think there's some point there, you know, they're going after people who express sympathy with political ideas that, you know.
Jennifer Granick, that is all we are going to have time for. Thank you very much for joining us on the show. And I'm sure we will have cause to have another chat to you again this year. Cheers.
I hope so.
Jennifer Granick there with a chat about all things cyber law. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Julian Fay, the Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of Senetas. Senetas designs and manufactures level 2 crypto gear, which I guess Crown Casino probably could have used for its CCTV network to avoid that little $32 million problem in their casino. There's a wild idea. A lot of people do use this layer 2 stuff for CCTV networks. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, go to www.senetas.com. That's S-E-N-E-T-A-S. And check out their stuff, especially if you are planning any sort of greenfields deployments, low latency, that sort of thing. Good stuff. Now, today we're chatting to Julian about some odd requests the company gets every now and then. Sometimes Senetas will come across a customer who wants to roll their own crypto into Senetas's hardware. So I thought I'd ask Julian, why? And is it a good idea, you know, when people are doing this? Do they actually know what they're getting themselves into? Julian joined me via Skype and I asked him all about it. Here he is.
We often get approached by various organizations who ask if they can use our hardware encryption platform, but put what I'd term non-standard crypto in there. And I guess non-standard, I mean anything other than AES. And I guess that can fall into two categories. Either it could be a sovereign nation algorithm, perhaps even one that's published and has been subject to peer review. So some examples of that might be Seed that South Korea developed. And there's some interesting stories about the impact of Seed in South Korea, or Camellia in Japan, or the Russian algorithm GOST. So those are kind of published, peer-reviewed algorithms, so at least they're open. But sometimes it's like a black box approach, and they just say, well, you know, we want to encrypt this network traffic, and we need some hardware appliance to do it. So, you know, can we just give you this black box of this secret crypto algorithm? Would you guys be prepared to put it into your product for us?
But how does that work? I mean, how is it possible for you to bake in an algo and not actually, and for that to be still be a black box? Like, what?
It's difficult is the answer. Very difficult. It's much easier on a software appliance, which we do have in some of our lower end, lower bandwidth models, where you can basically just publish an API or a software development kit, and they could essentially provide a binary, some sort of library that you can plug into your product. And as long as you define the specs for that, the interface for data goes in, some sort of data comes out, it's gone through some sort of black box algorithm, we haven't got a clue what it does, then that's quite feasible to do. And, you know, we actually provide a toolkit in some of our software products where we will publish an API, we'll hand it over to some of those products, those organizations, and then they can basically load a library into it and run it to their heart's content. But it does get really tricky at the higher speeds because all of our crypto there is basically done in silicon, in programmable chips, and that's much harder. So one thing that we do talk about often is basically making some of the parameters of an algorithm like AES, the substitution boxes or the permutation boxes, actually user configurable. So you can actually publish through the normal management interface and give the user the ability to actually go in and set different SBox parameters, for example.
Now, why is it that you think that they want to do this? I mean, I'm imagining that it's a security through obscurity thing, which everyone knocks, but honestly, you know, it can be a pretty effective approach. I mean, if you've got some solid crypto, as long as it's reasonably solid, if no one knows what it is, it's very difficult for them to exploit weaknesses in it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And there's, you know, I guess there's a bit of a contradiction here, even in terms of, you know, what the NSA does. So, you know, on one hand, you've got, you know, you've got this principle, Kirkhoff's principle, which says that the security of the system should not be compromised if all the details of it are exposed other than the key. In other words, all of the security relies on the key, and that the algorithm could be fully published, etc. And that seems like a pretty good basis on which to build your crypto. And, you know, you hear stories of some brilliant teenager in his bedroom's designed some algorithm overnight that's going to blow AES away, and then as soon as anybody with half a brain's had a chance to look at it, they find it's full of vulnerabilities. Yet, you look at the NSA sort of high-grade, top-level classified algorithms, which fall under the Suite A set of algorithms, and they are completely secret. They're obviously non-disclosed. We don't know what those algorithms are. We certainly don't get access to themselves. So really, it's the difference between having the resources of someone like the NSA or the Chinese government or the Indian government, who have got probably the best mathematicians and cryptographers in the world and can actually do sufficient peer review within their own communities, versus a couple of guys who got to start up the next business with the best and brightest crypto algorithm, or so they claim.
Well, and the thing is, if you find a weakness in an AES implementation, I mean, these days, you're not likely to make a lot of noise about that, are you? Because that's going to be used by some, you know, interesting organizations like the NSA. I mean, that knowledge of the weaknesses, you know, people assume, oh, it's published, so people will find weaknesses in it and make a lot of noise about it, but that's not necessarily so these days.
Absolutely, yeah. And we don't know what intelligence agencies around the world can actually do with AES. And people keep asking, you know, is it possible that AES has a backdoor? Can the NSA break it? But, you know, you've got to think this through. So NSA in 2003 approved AES for top secret classified data use within the US defense sector. So that means that they're happy to actually use it at the highest level of classified information. So if they knew that there was actually a vulnerability in that algorithm, then they'll be placing a bet that none of the brightest minds in the rest of the world, all the thousands of Chinese, India cryptographers, could find that same vulnerability and exploit it. And that's a pretty big bet to make when you're putting your highest level of data through that. So, you know, you just got to think through, is this actually a rational thing that could happen?
So you think suspicions around AES being some sort of Western, you know, Trojan deliberately weak thing is a bit silly?
I think so, when you think about it in that context of how broadly it has been peer-reviewed, how much it's been scrutinized, you know, even the selection process these days for crypto algorithms and the recent, you know, SHA-3 digest competition. You know, these are multi-year projects that algorithms are published, they're whittled down to the best few, they're subject to tons of review. Doesn't mean there's not a problem in there. I'm not saying definitively, but look at it from all of the available evidence, it seems very unlikely.
So why is it that these customers are requesting custom algos going into your kit? I mean, is it because of an irrational distrust, or is it just because it's the way they do things? I mean, what's the real reason here?
Well, sometimes there's basically a legal obligation within a sovereign state that they will use a local crypto algorithm. And that's just part of their information security culture, is that they have decided that however secure other algorithms are, they will only trust one that's developed in country. And often they publish these. So a good example of that is Seed, that was developed in South Korea and has been mandated for use for all e-commerce within South Korea in the early 2000s, because at that time they didn't trust the 40-bit encryption that was available in SSL. So the government basically said, okay, all e-commerce in Korea has to use the Seed algorithm. But there have been some incredible ramifications of that decision that are still in place today. And basically what that is that the only implementation of Seed within SSL was through an ActiveX object that had to be pushed through the browser.
Yeah, I was going to ask how that all worked. And
So, yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with the story. It's a real cracker. They made this decision to go with Seed. The actual only practical implementation of it, because none of the SSL libraries supported Seed, was to push the code through an ActiveX object. And the only browser.
Yeah, is IE, right?
So what's happened is that basically for about the last 13 years, all of the Korean websites have been optimized for Internet Explorer. And they basically have this complete lock-in from through the user community to continue to use Internet Explorer. And that, the whole country is basically a slave to that browser because they couldn't swap over to any other browser because it didn't support the seed algorithm. And even when they changed the law in the mid-2010, I think it was, to actually end the compulsory use of it, there's still been very little further adoption. There's a guy actually standing for election on the basis that South Korea, despite all its huge technology development capabilities, is actually way behind in terms of modern web and browser infrastructure. And by all accounts, if you go there and you try and browse with Chrome or Opera or another modern browser, then it just looks absolutely shocking. Nothing works. It all looks like a real mess. It's a real side effect from a decision that was made 10 years ago from a security perspective.
Yeah, no, that's a weird one, and I've got to say, Julian, it's the first I've actually heard that story. So I've just been sitting here listening. I've been amazed by it. But look, I mean, what's the real motivation of a lot of these guys using the custom algos? I mean, that seems like almost a rational distrust of a 40-bit algo, but it's still a weird decision that's had some weird ramifications. But I mean, how many of these countries, I mean, you're actually taking some of these custom algos. I imagine you have a little bit of insight into them. I mean, what are the odds that they're actually, you know, actually solid? I mean, are they good?
Well, if the Indian government approached us, say, and said, we have a sovereign algorithm that we've developed, I can't divulge it to you, but we want to embed it into your appliance through a black box approach, I would probably have pretty high confidence that algorithm has had sufficient peer review that it's probably pretty good, just given the depth of capability and the talent of that country. If another smaller country approached us, organization within that country, perhaps, because it's not just necessarily a sovereign state. It could be a particular organization within that country who has this as a policy, say a military unit or something. Then you really have to think that probably has not had the depth of scrutiny that it should have had. And, you know, in crypto, to be honest, you want to be boring. You want to go with the rest of the pack. You don't want to stand out. You want to use conservative, well-understood software libraries. You want to use published algorithms, be as boring as you can, because you don't want to be the guy who gets caught out because you did something different.
So who are the likely candidates? I mean, who is it that comes to you and asks you to roll this custom stuff? Is that like, you know, countries in the Middle East? Is it, I mean, where are they mostly located?
Yeah, can't go into specific organizations, obviously, but generally they're in Asia and the Middle East and Eastern Europe. Of those organizations. So the kind of organizations I'd guess you'd expect, who as a matter of probably completely rational policy might say, where we think it's feasible, we would prefer to trust our own sovereign algorithm than to use AES.
And do you think that that's an approach that is, like, what proportion of these customers who insist on this custom stuff, what proportion of them do you feel are making a good decision?
Less than half. Only the ones that I would think have that substantial capability in-house. And then you have to think, if they have the capability in-house to actually engineer the algorithm, then why aren't they building the whole product themselves?
Well, and this is the next question, obviously, which is, how do you go about supporting an algorithm that you're not allowed to understand, like that you don't have visibility on?
Yeah, again, and exactly. And sometimes the practical difficulties of this actually preclude us actually getting to the state where we can help them out. So we have a lot of conversations, but we actually have far fewer projects that are actually developed at the end of the day. But, you know, we are supportive of those requests. In some cases, it's completely rational and we can help those guys out. But often just the practical difficulties, because it's not just the encryption algorithm that counts here. You've got to ask broader questions about, you know, what are your key management protocol you're using, how are your keys generated, how are you going to manage this device, etc. You know, it's a whole system-wide security approach that you need to think about. We're happy to have those conversations and help out while we can, but often the practical difficulties just mean that it can't be realized.
But I mean, I fully don't understand how you can not have visibility on the algo if you're integrating this into your hardware products. I mean, how does that work?
Well, there are now capabilities in FPGAs for partial reconfiguration, without getting too technical. What that means is
you ship them off to the customer for the partial reconfiguration.
So basically you can load the config on site through a normal software update mechanism, and that will update a part of the firmware that implements the crypto algorithm in that chipset. And that's a feature in modern FPGA chips that will allow this sort of capability.
So you basically provide, you know, essentially you wind up providing a platform that's, you know, got the last little bit of it that the customer can bake in themselves.
Exactly, yeah. So it's like publishing an API or a software development kit. You know, we define a set of interfaces, everyone works to those interfaces, and then they can build their FPGA image or their crypto algorithm on their own toolkit, and as long as it's compliant with our interface requirements, they can load it in into that product set.
All right, well, Julian Fay, it's been a pleasure to chat to you, as always, and I guess we'll check in with you again in another 4 weeks.
Thanks, Pat. Cheers.
Julian Fay there of Senatas in this week's sponsor interview. So as I say, go to www.senatas.com and check out all of their machines with lights that go bing. This week's track is called Long Time and it's by a local artist named Ash Gronwell. And I really included this one for the film clip, which is linked to from this week's show notes. Ash lives in the same area as me, which is Byron Shire in northern New South Wales. And this film clip really, really sort of just captures the area. The people, the surf. It's the sort of thing that if I was away and feeling a bit homesick, I'd watch this film clip and get all weepy. And if you're a surfer yourself, you'll probably recognise a few people doing some of the silly lip syncs in this. I mean, there's some mad surfing in this. There's guys like Dave Rastovich, who's a free surfer. Bob McTavish makes an appearance. The other singer, Xavier Rudd. Even World Longboard Championship winner, I think he won a couple of times, Bo Young, Nat Young's son. These guys are just shredding in some little waves at the pass in Broken Head. So it's a really fun clip, and I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. To drop if I wanna survive.